This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode 160. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful blog, portfolio, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace offers beautiful templates, an elegant interface, and incredible 24/7 support. Start building your website today at squarespace.com, and when you check out, make sure to enter the offer code IMPROVE at checkout to receive an additional 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Everybody, welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. By listening to this podcast, you are joining thousands of other photographers, all joining in to partake in the nerdery that is the Improved Photography Podcast and talk about the things that we're passionate about and the things that we love. So to help me talk about the things that we love, I am joined today by nobody. Everybody bailed on Nick today. Jim is busy photographing snow monkeys in Japan, and Jeff is sick, and yeah, everybody just pretty much bailed on Nick. But that's okay. We have lots of news to talk about today, and so hopefully I can get through that without too many terrible mishaps. So there's big news this week, news that a lot of people have been waiting for. Canon has announced a new camera. It's the 1DX Mark II. The 1DX is their flagship camera, meaning it's the most expensive camera in their entire lineup, but it's also the coolest, most fanciest, awesomest camera that they have. The 1DX has been like the main sports photography, journalist photography camera on the Canon side. And they've just announced their newest one here. And the specs are actually pretty exciting. I've been spending a little bit of time comparing the specs against the Nikon D5 because it's its direct competitor. And they hold up pretty well. Some of the newest stuff that's come out with this camera, it's got a newly developed 20.2 megapixel full frame sensor. Newly developed is the part that I'm excited about there. I'm hoping for better ISO performance, but we will not know that until we actually get one in our hands and people start like posting reviews of the sensor and the image quality. But we have to assume it's at least a little bit of an improvement. Continuous shooting speeds of up to 14 frames per second or 16 frames per second in live view mode. That is fast. That is super fast. That is 2 frames per second faster than the Nikon D5. So props to Canon for that. That's just machine gun speed. That's pretty exciting. Dual Digic 6 processors. It should process images really fast through the cards. You can write up to 170 consecutive RAW files when shooting at 14 frames per second. But that's only if you're using the CFast cards. Now, this camera is coming with 2 card slots. It's coming with a CFast card slot and a compact flash card slot. CFast is, as it sounds, it's a little bit faster than compact flash. But if you're recording to a compact flash card, you're only going to get, I don't have that number in front of me, but I want to say that it's around 75 files consecutively before you start running out of buffer. So the problem with that is that if you're writing to 2 cards, you're going to be limited by your slowest card. So that is an issue. It would be pretty cool if it was actually using the same card slots, those CFast card slots. It would suck to have to buy new cards, but at the same time, you might as well embrace the faster technology. So not sure how I feel about having 2 different type of card slots in there. Now, the video aspect of this is really exciting for anybody that will be using it for video. It's capable of shooting 4K at 60 frames per second, which is really, really good. That's double the capability of the Nikon D5, and it'll do full HD at 120 frames per second. That is cool. Full HD at 120 frames per second. Very cool. If you remember when we were talking about the D5, it had that 3-minute limit on the length of the files that it could do in 4K. Canon doesn't have that. It'll still do a half hour. So video capabilities, it's blowing away the D5. It's touch screen, so when you're in video mode, you can touch to focus. That's really cool. But again, you know, if you're buying this camera, you're probably not buying it for video. You're buying it for stills. And we won't know how good the image quality is until we get to see some of those first tests roll in. The ISO range is not as high as the Nikon, and that doesn't really mean anything, but it might mean that it doesn't perform quite as well at those higher ISOs. The Canon, the natively goes from 100 to 51,200, and it's expandable to 409,000 ISO, which is really, really high, admittedly. But the Nikon, its native ISO range is 100 to 102,000, and then you can extend that to 3,280,000, which, I mean, that's a large discrepancy between the two cameras. It leads me to believe, and we won't know until we actually see the first images from these cameras, it sounds like the Nikon is going to have an edge on ISO performance. One place that the Canon does have an edge on the Nikon is it's coming in at almost $1,000 cheaper. It's going to be selling for $5,900, which is expensive. And the Nikon is going to be selling for $6,400 or almost $6,500. So Canon is going to be cheaper. I like that. It's going to be faster and it's going to have much better video, but we don't know about the image quality. Also, the Canon has not upgraded their autofocus very much. It still has 61 points of phase detection focus points and 41 of those are cross type. Compare that to the D5 that has, let's see, it has 153 phase detection points and 99 of those are cross-type. So that's a pretty large discrepancy there as well. So we're going to kind of have to see what happens there. But still, the Canon is pretty exciting to me. I'm hoping that a lot of these same specs trickle down into the 5D Mark IV, which is kind of more in the realm of possibility for most of us people that are not doctors and lawyers. And, you know, because I don't think that I'm going to be shelling out $5,900 for a camera, although I would absolutely love to own the thing. So it looks like it's going to be available in April, and hopefully by then we will have a new Canon 5D Mark IV to be talking about as well, because that's the camera that I'm excited about since I'm in the Canon camp. So we also had a question come in over on the Improved Photography Podcast listeners page on Facebook. If you're not a member of the Facebook group already, you really should be. It's a great way for us to get questions from our audience, kind of interact with you all, share what we're doing, and it gives you guys an opportunity to share what you're doing and get input from all the other listeners. So it's really fun to be a part of that. Nick asks, "Hey all, I remember a podcast from the distant past about lightning photography. You mentioned a gizmo that is triggered by lightning, yet can also be programmed to do a bazillion other functions. Any ideas on what it was?" And it was actually me that had talked about this device. I want to say it's just the Nero trigger. So I picked that up for the purpose of using it for lightning photography. It's got a lightning mode. It advertises that lightning will set it off, and I just never had very good results with that thing. It's got several different modes. It can be triggered by bursts of light, which lightning should in theory produce. It can be triggered by sound. So for example, I've seen videos where people will set it up and they'll pop a balloon, and the sound of the balloon popping will trigger the camera, and you can get some really cool explosion effects. You could do all kinds of things. You could set it up focused on a golf ball and then hit the golf ball, and you should get that moment of impact. But there's a little bit of lag there, so it can be kind of finicky. So there's a sound mode. There's also a lightning beam mode where you point a laser beam. It'd be very hard to point a lightning beam. You point the laser beam at the Nero trigger, and if that beam is interrupted by anything, it goes off. So, for example, if you were trying to catch something in flight, I don't know, like I've seen examples of people setting this up in a studio, and then they have a bird fly past the camera. Well, as soon as the bird interrupts that laser beam, it's going to set off the camera. So it just automatically takes that. And in theory, you could set this up in a way to where you could photograph wildlife like this. It sounds very difficult to do, but in theory, you could do it. Like I said, I never had good results using it for lightning. I took it out several times and we had a really awesome lightning storm coming through. In its default setting, it was too sensitive. So every single, it was just being set off by everything. You know, the ambient light was setting it off. And as I decreased the sensitivity, I got it down to where it wasn't being triggered anymore. And then lightning would happen and then it still wouldn't trigger. So I was never able to really dial in the sensitivity properly. And I spent all of my time fiddling with it and I was missing really awesome lightning strikes, which is really incredibly frustrating when they only happen a few times a year. So I never really had good results with it, but I've heard of people having good results with it. I know there's other lightning triggers out there. You might give one of those other ones a try, but it's kind of crazy how expensive they are given what they are. They're basically just a little plastic box that you spend $300 for. And a lot of times, like all the reviews I've ever seen for them have been, you know, build quality is terrible, feels like really cheaply made, terrible products. And you really don't get a whole lot for your money. So for me, like when it comes to photographing lightning, I like to just use bulb mode, hold down the bulb shutter until lightning goes off and then let go. Or if it's dark enough, I do long exposures and I get them that way. So for me, that's where I've had the best luck.
So I've got a lot more that I want to talk about before we do, let's talk a little bit about Squarespace, the sponsor of this show. So thank you, Squarespace, for making this episode possible. Squarespace and I go way, way back. I've pretty much had my portfolio on Squarespace since the beginning, but there were those dark ages before I switched to Squarespace. I was trying to use some of the other websites out there, and it was just such a hassle to keep my portfolio updated that I pretty much never did. And that's a bad thing for a photographer. You kind of have to keep your website updated. So the ease of an update is probably my favorite part of Squarespace. I've also implemented an online store through Squarespace. I'm selling things like wallpapers for people's desktops. I'm selling admission to my workshops. I'm selling Skype tutorials. And it was really easy to set up. It wasn't hard at all. So Squarespace just offers so much for us photographers, and I highly, highly recommend them. So you can go over, you can start building your website for free, check out all the tools, see if there's something in there that you like. And then when you are ready to sign up for the year or whatever, like I guarantee that you're going to want to do, make sure you enter improve at checkout and that will save you an extra 10%. So make sure you go check out Squarespace, and we thank Squarespace for your support of the Improved Photography Podcast.
Okay, so some of you may have seen the post where I talked about how I was going to take some flash gear to a basketball game. I posted about this on the Facebook group. So I shoot a lot of high school basketball. After a while, you get a little bit bored with doing the same thing over and over. And so I thought, you know, a fun experiment would be to take some of my high-speed sync flashes. I have three of them. Take them to a game and then have somebody hold them for me up in the stands. And so I did that. I wasn't sure. First of all, I wasn't sure if it was going to get me kicked out of the game or not, because, you know, you are taking flash into a game. And that's typically, like, I've always talked about how that's not a good thing. You don't want to be blinding your players. And I would never even consider doing on-camera flash. That's a terrible idea. So I was afraid of getting kicked out and annoying people. And secondly, I was curious if my flashes would even be strong enough to have much of an effect. I tried this out yesterday and it went kind of good. Like there was definitely a learning curve to it. I shot the second half of the girls' basketball game and got very few good results from that. I spent pretty much the entire game just fiddling with different combinations of settings. And then towards the middle of the boys' game, I started getting settings that I liked. And so some of the issues that I was running into was, initially, I just put all three on my triple flash bracket and then had Annalise up in the stands holding them and just kind of follow the ball with it. I found that having my light come from one side, just, you know, you'd end up with one bright side
and everything else would fall into shadow. And so what I did was I took one of those flashes and then I moved it to the other side of the court. That way I had light coming from both sides and illuminating the subjects as they would get, you know, into the key area. And I had better luck with that, because if one flash was blocked by other players, the other one would, in theory, more than likely hit the players that I was trying to photograph. And I had decent luck with it. I found that, like, I was able to, like, really overpower the ambient light at times, but I was having to use fairly high ISOs to do that. If you're not familiar with how flash typically works, normally you have a maximum sync speed. So on my particular camera, a 5D Mark III, 1/200th of a second is the fastest that I can use, the fastest shutter speed I can use while using the typical flash. Any faster than that, and I'm going to start getting little black bars across my frame where the flash just didn't have enough time to illuminate the entire frame, because that shutter is just going across the scene so fast. So to overcome this, some flashes have the high speed sync option, which means that it sends out a whole bunch of quick little bursts. That way, as those shutters are moving across your sensor, you get light in every single little part of your frame. The problem with doing this is that you lose a lot of power from your flashes. So you're operating with like maybe 1/5 the amount of power that you did initially. But the cool thing is that now you can use any shutter speed you want. So there was times where I was experimenting with 1/8,000th of a second, and then pretty much the only light in the entire building was my flashes. So I was able to overpower the ambient light like that, and I came away with some very moody results. It's not a look that I would want to go with very often, but it is kind of fun to just be able to do that once in a while. Because I shoot so many games and I'm shooting for a newspaper, I really don't think that particular style is really appropriate for newspapers, but it looks cool for like magazine type work where, you know, maybe they're doing a story about one of the players or something and they want something kind of artsy and moody and cool. That's kind of the look that I was getting when I was overpowering the ambient light. The results that I did like, though, was when I would just kind of accent the players lightly. So I would use very similar settings to what I would normally use, only maybe underexposing that by half a stop, just so it's a little bit, you know, darker than I would normally go with. And then just add a little bit of accent light to the players. And it just gives a little bit more depth and dimension to the players. And I was liking that result a lot better. Unfortunately, it took me a game and a half before I realized that. So I really didn't get a whole lot of shots I loved. That was definitely the result that I liked best, was the more subtle use of it. It definitely cleaned up the images just a little bit by adding those highlights. It gave it a kind of a nice look, but it also meant that I couldn't just rattle off photos. Bam, 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 bam. I couldn't motor drive through an entire sequence. I had to wait for my moments and pick my shots. And because of that, I ended up losing or missing a lot of shots, because I would capture that right moment, and then either somebody was blocking my light, or the person was blinking, or I slightly missed focus. So I came away with a lot fewer keepers just because I was having to pick my moments so much. And then if I picked the wrong moment, I just didn't get anything. So there's definitely some pros and cons. I don't think that bringing flashes to a game is going to be something that I do on a regular basis, just because it's not practical. It was kind of a pain, and I found myself missing a lot of moments. So there was a lot of people that were talking about how inconsiderate it is for the players to have to put up with some, I think somebody referred to me as an arrogant photographer, bringing his flash equipment to the game. And what I have to say to that is that my flashes were in the stands. They were not where the players are looking and focusing on. Had I, like, you know, put the flash on my camera and then waited for them to face me and then blasted them with light, yes, that would totally not be acceptable. Or if
you know, even if I had my lights in the corners where they might be looking in that direction, if they're shooting a three pointer or something from the baseline, that would probably not be acceptable. But because my lights were above eye level and they were in the crowd, I wasn't too worried about it. I didn't have a single ref, parent, or player complain about it or even raise an eyebrow about it. So I really don't think that that was too much of an issue. And if you think about it, if you've ever watched an NBA game and they show, you know, the entire crowd, there are flashes going off like crazy in there because a lot of those photographers have flash gear, you know, in the stadium, and everybody in the crowd that has, you know, a DSLR in automatic mode, they all have their flashes up because they're in a dark environment and their automatic mode's going to give them a flash to use. So I don't think that it's that big of a deal as long as you're not flashing it right into their faces. So yeah, but having said that, I'm not even sure that it's worth the trouble. It adds a little something. I think ideally, the best situation would be to somehow put your lights like up in the rafters, shooting down. That way you're actually creating a very a type of light that you would expect to see. Then you can really add that power, and it's not going to be nearly as inconsistent as it is shooting from the sides and just hoping that you're going to actually hit the player you're trying to hit. So yeah, that was a little bit of my foray into flashing basketball players, and it went fairly well, I think. I didn't go to jail. All right, so every week we like to leave you with our favorite doodads. I think I'm going to pick two doodads this week since there's nobody else to give you guys doodads. So my first doodad this week is the Amazon Basics high capacity rechargeable batteries. I've talked about on the show before that I like to use the black Amazon batteries, and these are what I'm talking about. They are very, very comparable to the N-Loop batteries that are very popular with strobe photographers. I've found these to be every bit as good, and they're cheaper. So these are the Amazon Basic high capacity rechargeables. They're black. Make sure that they're, you know, not the white ones. The white ones don't have quite as much capacity. Really, really love these batteries. If you do a lot of flash photography, I highly recommend those. And the other doodad that I want to share with you guys this week is the Velo FreeWave wireless remote shutter. So basically all it is it's a remote shutter release, just like, you know, the cable releases that you see oftentimes, only it's wireless. So you put the receiver on your hot shoe, you plug it into your camera, and then you have this little remote with an antenna and a button on it. Really simple to use. It's really quick to use, and it has a really nice range. I believe it's 100 feet. Actually, no, it's 320 feet, 100 meters. And so you can sit in your car, drink your coffee, and fire away. And a lot of times this is quicker and easier for me, even though I own a Cam Ranger, because I don't have to set up my phone. I don't have to open the app. I don't have to connect. Don't have to do any of that other stuff. I just have to hit the button. And it works really well. I strap it to my backpack, so I've always got it on my camera bag, and it's good to go. So that's the Velo FreeWave wireless remote shutter release. We'll put a link in the show notes. All right, thanks so much, guys, for tuning in. Hopefully I kept it interesting with just me here this week, and we will see you in another 7 days. Thanks so much.